Hi there, listener. It's Matthew. You've come looking for an episode of the Children's Book Podcast, and you've found it. Hooray! But you're probably wondering why the name of the podcast has changed. After 8 years of doing the Children's Book Podcast, I began a new career as head of podcasts at A Kids Company About, where I now oversee a podcast network dedicated to producing original content that talks up to kids, centers the things going on in their world, and engages and challenges how they see the world and themselves. All of the episodes of the Children's Book Podcast are still here, but now, if you're subscribed, you'll get new episodes of Worth Noting, a kids podcast about current events, hosted by me. Something for you and the young people in your life to enjoy together. Enjoy this episode, and I hope you'll check out Worth Noting and other podcasts from A Kids Company About. The Let's Get Busy podcast is produced in part by All the Wonders, a home for readers to discover new books and to experience the stories they love in wondrous ways. Go beyond the book at allthewonders.com. Welcome to Let's Get Busy, a weekly podcast where I talk shop and get down to business with authors, illustrators, award winners, up-and-comers, and everyone in between. I'm Matthew Winner. This is episode number 237 of the podcast with Hannah Barnaby, author of Some of the Parts, her newest YA novel. Anna talks about building trust with her readers to know that the characters are going to be okay. It's a conversation we got into early because of the content of her newest novel, in which a sister seeks out the organ donor recipients that connect her to her recently deceased brother. Anna is the perfect person to be writing these words, as I think you'll quickly agree after listening to her. Her voice and candor are immediately calming, and it's easy to know that she's on the side of her readers for the journey her stories will take. Here is episode number 237 of the podcast with Hannah Barnaby. Let's get busy. Welcome to the Let's Get Busy podcast, Hannah Barnaby. I am excited that we finally get to talk.
Me too. I've been waiting a long time.
It has been a long time. Thank you, by the way, BT Dubs, for sharing Wonder Show with me.
You're so welcome.
I got through, and I know we have had conversations about how slow I read. I am proud to say I got through half of it, and it is still on my nightstand. I will be continuing this book. It is wonderful.
Good. And hey, I mean, the longer it takes you to read it, the longer it gets to live on your nightstand. So
it gets to live there. You're right. It's nice. You know what? Having books around, all of us who have books around, it's a nice thing. I like that I've got like books on my kitchen table and books on my table in here in my office where I do the podcast and books upstairs. I like that. I like being surrounded by my friends with all of you and also being surrounded by good books. And just, I think also like the fact that my kids are growing up and seeing books are around.
Yeah.
That's a really good thing.
That's huge. That's so important.
You've had like a long time in books. I want to talk with you about working in publishing and all that, because I know you know I'm really fascinated by that. But I want to make sure we get to talk about your new book off the bat. I want to talk about Some of the Parts.
Okay.
Because this is a YA book.
It is.
There's some stuff going on in this book, Hannah. This is a serious book. I'm an elementary school librarian, so whenever I get to read,
every time I start a new story, I'm like, "This is gonna be like my fun, like lighthearted."
There, say it, yeah.
Funny book. Like, I have a good sense of humor. I make people laugh. Like, I'm fun.
And I love your self talk. I just want to start by saying I love your self talk. I have a good sense of humor. I'm fun.
It's like my affirmation. I'm good enough.
I'm smart enough. And doggone it, people like me.
And sometimes I'm funny. But I don't know. I've always been drawn to intense, emotional, dark stories. And so that's just what keeps happening.
You write well. You write good, intense stories really well. Why don't I give you a chance first just to book talk your book, to give a summary of your book.
Okay. So Some of the Parts is a young adult novel, as you said, and it is the story of a girl named Tally who has lost her brother in a car accident. And she feels completely responsible for the accident, and she's been just riddled with guilt ever since it happened. And she's kind of forcing herself to try and get back to normal. She wants to, you know, be herself again and feel like herself again. And just when she's sort of on the verge of being able to do that, she discovers through a letter that she receives in the mail that her brother's organs were donated after he died. And this is something that her parents just hadn't discussed with her. And so it becomes something that she gets a little fixated on and a little carried away with, trying to find his organ recipients as a way to heal herself and also reconnect with him.
To say that this is a different story than I normally write or than I normally read, I think is kind of stating the obvious.
Yeah.
But I like that I'm connected with you, because then it gives me a chance to read something like this. It gives me permission to break from what I normally read to read something like this. And also it gives me a chance to have on my nightstand a book that's older that my wife is like, "Oh, you have a YA book? Can I read it?"
Chicks dig YA.
I mean, it's sort of a thing. Amy, to be fair, is always interested in whatever I'm reading. But whenever it's a YA novel, she sort of feels like, okay, so in the same funny way that I get mail and Jonah's like, "Teddy, are those boxes for you? Is it more books?" In that same way, when something like this comes in, Amy's always excited to get her stab at it because she's the right person for me, and because she's a reader, and because it's all of those good things. But this is an intense story, and it's sad. And I think that I like your frankness in the story, and the way that you deal with emotion up front, I think is something that, I don't know, I always read books as myself. And then I secondly think of the children who will read it. And I like that quality, because then it helps me understand myself more through your writing. And then how, as readers, we are able to connect with one another, right?
Yeah.
And this is sort of one of those stories that I felt like it was all going to be okay if I just kept reading. You were going to carry me through this, and it was going to be okay.
You can trust me. The thing is that I, even though I am drawn to the sort of dark, tough stuff, I mean, writing a novel, it takes a long time, for me especially. And once you've spent that much time with a character, the last thing you want to do is just dump them on the side of the road and drive away, right? Like you want to give them something at the end of the book, even if it's not all neatly tied up in a pretty ribbon. You know, they've been through something and you need to honor that. But I want to make sure that they're okay. Like that I'm dropping them off somewhere that they can be okay and that they can be happy.
Okay, so I'm writing this down, making sure your characters are okay. Because before you make sure that they're okay, you have to put them in a situation where they're not okay, right?
Right, you have to do a bunch of terrible stuff to them first.
Your word's not mine, but you're absolutely right. So... Yeah. So for you, for this in particular story, for some of the parts where, I mean, losing a sibling and then organ donation and then trying to find answers as a child, as a young adult, but still as a child trying to find answers, where are you drawing from, Hannah, to come at this?
Yeah. So I lost a brother 17 years ago. And he was a younger brother, not an older brother. So there's a lot of, you know, differences, factual differences in the novel and some of the parts compared to my own experience. But the emotional trajectory is very much what I went through. So I was revisiting a lot of my own experiences and feelings and transitions and reactions to stuff that I went through 17 years ago. And it's amazing how it didn't take very much for me to tap back into that. And if you had asked me before I started writing it, I would have probably said, you know, it was really tough, but I've moved on. Mm-hmm. I mean, a lot has happened since then. And but it was so vivid. It came back so quickly and so strongly. And that made writing the book very, very difficult, but also really rewarding because I could tell right away as soon as I started writing it. I thought, you know, there are kids out there who have been through something like this.
Yeah.
Lots of kids who have lost someone important to them. And I think I can do this in a way that they're going to recognize themselves and they're not going to feel like I'm not doing this right or there's something wrong with me. Or, you know, I really wanted them to see that you will be changed. You should be changed by things like this. And that's okay.
The fact that you're pulling from experience and also almost giving advice to your previous self, right? Yeah. When you're writing, when I was reading it, it made me think of, and it, I guess I'm experiencing a lot of similar emotions. I'm realizing, when I was in high school, I was involved in theater, and on the opening night of one of our, plays that we were doing, one of the guys that I was in the play with, before walking out onto stage, had a heart attack and died right on stage.
Oh my gosh.
And I remember not like being on the other wing, so not witnessing it happen that way, but just how fast and how slow things went.
Yeah.
And I remember being out of school and sort of being, I guess, in shock and not really understanding how to feel and not knowing, am I feeling anything at all? Or what's going on? Am I doing this right? Like you said that, and that's what's coming to me too. Still now feeling like, did I do everything right for Jonathan? Even then, was I the right person? Or maybe there's just some experiences that we're meant to go through, that we're meant to experience and just to be there for other people, even if we're not like there for other people. It just was making me think of that so much and about how for me, I didn't have anyone to talk to and I wasn't reading. So I didn't know how to deal with it. So maybe as much as I felt like I moved on, there's always sort of hints that of life that bring me back to that moment and in the story that was what was going on with me too. It's just bringing back to that moment going like, this is real and this is something that you have to deal with or that you can choose to not deal with. And it's, there's not really any way to do it the right way.
Here I am
stumbling over my words. Dear God, I'm back in it again. I'm so sorry, Hannah.
No, it's true because there's no recipe for it. There's no, and even if, you know, I looked for books right after it happened because I had always been comforted by books my whole life and had always been a reader, like most writers will say that they were. And I didn't find anything that was like what I was feeling.
Right.
And so that did make me think like, oh my gosh, I'm not even feeling the right stuff.
Yes.
Right. And I mean, I have another younger brother who his experience was totally different than mine, I'm sure, in a lot of ways. And that's the thing about loss and grief is that, I mean, even if somebody was standing right next to you when your friend had that heart attack, you and that other person's experience wouldn't be the same either, because then you leave that moment and you go off in two different directions. And then everything that happens to you is built on that experience and affects that experience.
Yeah.
In a very unique way.
So when you were writing this story, when you were, I mean, even drafting it, what does writing a story look like to you? So you have this story that you want to tell because you've been through it and you feel on your heart that it's an important story to tell people because it's going to serve kids the right way. But then where do you go to not make it so frankly autobiographical or how do you find these characters and follow them? Weighted question, loaded question. Sorry. Yeah. I don't know what I do.
I'm panicking.
I have a magic eight ball.
That's right. It's like Mad Libs, really. You just fill it all in. No, writing takes a long time for me. I'm a slow writer and it's a very layered process. So pretty much my entire first draft of a novel is all about getting to know those characters. And I've completed many drafts that have essentially no plot whatsoever.
Wow.
Yeah, which is is terrible.
But you're writing to not go like backwards. You're just writing to move forwards and get to know the characters.
Yeah. So it's a lot of like flailing around and like, and I can tell myself, I mean, I can see it objectively enough that I can tell myself like, okay, something needs to happen in this scene or it's just a monologue. So I can, you know, kind of make things happen, but you can tell pretty quickly when you're drafting if you're guiding your characters in a direction that's not right for them. And so there's a lot of like correction of the direction that you're walking in with them and just figuring out who they are. And sometimes I'll get all the way through a draft before I'm like, oh, that's what she wants. And the objective in this story was always clear. I knew what she wanted. I just didn't always know if she was going to get it or how she was going to get it or if it was the right thing for her. And there's a scene where she's talking to her father and he says to her, you know, sometimes what you think you needed isn't what you needed.
Yeah.
And that was a really important moment, I think, for her and for me is showing that moment of revelation, like, sometimes you have to change direction. And I think that's true of drafting, of writing too. So it really changed between what I considered like the final draft. And then when Melanie Cheka at Knopf bought it, and we went through the editing process and I'll tell you like the biggest difference is when I sent this, when the manuscript went to Melanie, Tally was actually developing some kind of infection and she was hallucinating and seeing her brother and talking to him. And he was kind of guiding her through the whole journey.
Oh.
And I wrote it that way, I think, to kind of protect her and also myself, because I wanted her to still be able to have contact with him.
Okay, yeah. Instead like, of just letting her do it herself, yeah.
Yeah, I wanted them to be able to, like, spend time together. And I wanted him to be in the book. You know, I didn't want him to be gone just as much as she didn't want him to be gone. And before Melanie acquired it, I had a phone call with her. And she said, you know, I love this and I want to work on it. But I'll tell you, if I give you a contract for it, I'm going to ask you to change this whole piece of it. Are you okay with that? And I had to really think about it. And her point was that if he was just there to lead her through the whole thing, she wasn't making the choices for herself. And I think that was so true that I needed to, it was like the final Jenga piece that I needed to pull out of the puzzle in order to really make it like, okay, she's making these things happen. She's deciding these things for herself and the consequences will be hers also, but she needed to be driving the story and she wasn't as long as he was there to hold her up.
But even like just reflecting on your process, I can't imagine to get to know Tally as well as you did. And then, to do that to her, to take Nate out of her life. I mean, almost to take Nate out of her life again. Yeah, exactly.
That's what it felt like. It was terrible.
Jeez.
But she was right. Melanie was totally right. I mean, she's a brilliant editor and she could see, and it's so amazing to me that she could see that just reading the story, you know, reading that draft, the state that it was in, she could see beyond what was there to what it could be.
But that's
what a great editor really does.
That seeing beyond you. Hannah, you were an editor in a past life, right?
I was, yes.
How is that something you're born into, the seeing beyond through experience, through reading lots of bad stuff? What, how do you, because I hear this, I mean, it's not right to call it a cliche, but it almost is.
You can call it a trope because that's a nice way of saying it.
That's the nice way of saying it. Yeah. Well, I wish the cliche wasn't such a dirty word because it sounds really fun to say. Trope sounds like troll. But you're right. It is a trope though in the story of writers getting a book to publication, that this great editor comes along and helps you see something that was sort of there all along, helps you realize what a great manuscript you had, if only you loosen this one piece.
Right.
But yeah, that's a thing. That's a thing that people say, because it's a thing.
It is. And it's all about objectivity, I think, and vision. And a good editor will be able to sort of balance those two things, like having passion for a story, but also being able to see it not just for what it is, not just for what's there, but what it could be. And then also to resist the compulsion to rewrite it for the author.
Oh.
and that's kind of what I knew. I mean, so yeah, I worked at Houghton Mifflin for 6 or 7 years, and I loved editing. I still do. I love working with authors and getting their stories into shape and critiquing things. And that's a whole part of my brain that I like to use. And in some ways, maybe it makes it easier. I guess it makes it easier to revise sometimes. It does not make it easy to draft. It makes drafting a terrible
to come from editing
a terrible process.
Really?
Yeah. Yes. Being like a type A personality, as I am, and a former editor, makes drafting like it's torture.
The notion really that you would tell me that you would write a draft without any, that would result with no plot, I can't even. Okay, no, I mean, you have to really divorce yourself from yourself to accomplish that. Yeah.
Absurd.
Well, it's writing, though. Writing's absurd.
Yeah. Yeah. Who knows? Why do we even do it?
What?
So I guess I would say when I was an editor, I did see a lot of, and I think this is how you can tell, like, sort of a more experienced writer from a less experienced writer. I would, Houghton was still taking unsolicited manuscripts at that point, and that was one of my jobs, was to open all of those envelopes and pile them all up and sort through all of them with interns and other people. And we found some good stuff in there, but we also found a lot of stuff that was comically bad. And you could tell the people who had even a little bit of experience had more ownership over their stories. So if I made revision suggestions to them, they wouldn't just type what I said into the manuscript. They would really take it and think about it and process it and make it their own, versus, you know, just taking my words and being like, there, I fixed it.
That makes sense. Yeah. Oh yeah.
You said to do this.
That's right. Yeah. You said, and take it.
Part of being a good editor is that guiding of writers and not stepping too far into the territory, but because so many editors, really great editors, are also really great writers. I mean, David Levithan is an example of, you know, someone who clearly has a brilliant understanding of story and how it's made on all levels. And it would be interesting to ask him, like, is it hard for you to not just rewrite this? Because I think that impulse is always a little bit there. And I think that was one of my first kind of internal tip-offs, that I would read stories and be like, oh, if I could just do this. And I found myself wanting to rewrite instead of edit. And then I started to think, oh, well.
So I should be writing. Yeah.
Maybe I need to be writing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Goodness. To be able to step back and look at that big picture feels, I mean, to put it in any other context, I have the experience of teaching. It feels like that, where it's, I can't really teach you how to be a good teacher. I can show you the tools.
Yeah.
But you sort of have to learn the path yourself. And if you do exactly what I'm telling you to do, it's probably not going to work out for you.
Right. It's just memorization, or it's like repetition. It's like learning your times tables and saying, yes, I know what 4 times 4 is, but do you really understand why 4 times 4 is 16?
Yeah, but man, that concept to be able to step back and go, I've read your 500-page manuscript and I can feel what you're trying to accomplish, and I see hope in it, or I see that there is no hope in it.
Well, there's always a little.
Well, there's always a little bit of hope. Because if there wasn't any hope, you wouldn't be sending it in, right?
Right.
Even if it's a fool's hope, there must be some sort of hope.
Yes.
Goodness. And then you wrote, and you still write, and you go through. So have you been able to separate yourself from, like, you write a draft of something, and then you're just like, I've spent months on this, but nope, this isn't going to be a thing.
Yeah, that has happened.
How soon have
definitely
you
happened?
Yeah, like, have you? Let's talk about abandoning your characters. How far in have you gotten at this point when you've just realized I need to, not that you need to abandon it, but you need to put it away for a while? Do you put stuff away? I've sometimes heard people say, like, they just put it in a file and don't open it for another year, months, or something.
I mean, I'm maybe a little different than some people. So some people find a story through the drafting process, and they'll just kind of sit down and start writing and, you know, get to maybe 50 pages or so and say, like, is this something? I don't know. Maybe not. And then either let it go or put it away. I do a lot of what I've taken to calling it pre-writing, because then it still has the word writing in it, even though I'm not putting any words anywhere. and that is, like, all the sort of mental gymnastics that I go through before I actually start writing a story. So I think about it a lot, and I picture, like, can I picture this character? Can I picture where she lives? And most of my stories start with a question or a situation. So with Tally, with some of the parts, it was like, what if there was a girl and her brother died? And then after that, she found out that parts of him were still in the world. What would that be like? And who would that happen to? And then I sort of build the characters from there. So it's really the situation that I start with, or the premise, I guess. And so I have all sorts of questions like that written down in different places, and many of them, I think, don't have the potential to support a whole novel.
Well, I feel like that helps that you worked for a publisher to be able to ask yourself, is this a book?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so far I haven't gotten, I've written 3-4 chapters of something and thought, I can't get this any further right now. But that's not to say, I mean, I think timing is very, very important in writing. And I think sometimes you're just not ready to write a story. You're just not in the right place for that story. But that's why saving things is so important, because you might come across it 10 years from now and say, oh, and see it in a whole different way. Like, oh yes, of course, obviously it should be this, but you couldn't have seen that when you started it. So, but it definitely, it's such a huge time investment, and it's easy to get discouraged when something isn't coming together the way that you want it to. And I think if there's just any part of it that's still kind of niggling at my brain, if I'm still, you know, I'm driving somewhere or I'm folding laundry or whatever, and I catch myself thinking about it, then I think there's something there. I may not have figured it out yet, but if I can't let it go, then I think there's something to it.
That makes sense. Are you at a place where you, like, I'm not sure what brought you into writing for young adults, but sometimes I hear that it just sort of depends on the story that's presented to you in your mind. But maybe the questions that you keep coming up with just do fit with an older audience. Yeah. Or do you find yourself, like, looking toward writing for adults or toward writing younger? Is that something that you ponder at all?
I do. So not writing for adults, because I think
it seems terrible, doesn't it?
I don't want to slander anyone, but most adults are not great readers. I mean, they're not readers in the way that teenage or, you know, the kids are readers. I mean, young readers, they are invested in reading, right? Like, they are so into a story and it means something to them and it changes them. And, like, they will defend that story to the death, because they love it. And there's having readers like that for something that you've written is amazing.
Yeah, because they take ownership. It becomes their story. It
yeah.
becomes part of their identity. I totally get that. I mean, you're saying you're writing. Really...
collaborative. It's a whole collaborative process.
Right.
And now I will say, so Anita Silvey was the publisher at the time that I worked at Houghton. I was her assistant, and her theory was that we write for the age at which we got stuck somehow.
Oh, so, I haven't heard it put that way. The age we got stuck.
Yeah. Like that something happened,
an emotional trauma kind of stuck.
Not necessarily trauma, but just like, so in the same way, I have a lot of friends who are teachers and they clearly have an affinity
for
a particular age group.
Right? Got it.
Like,
yep.
There are kindergarten teachers who are like, I could never teach middle school, but I love teaching kindergarten. And then there are middle school teachers who are like, kindergarten, not a chance.
Yeah, not that you couldn't do well teaching that different age, but just you feel an affinity. I get that. You could do some soul searching and feel that affinity. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's kind of just a natural, it's like your internal compass somehow.
Yeah.
Like, where is it pointing? And for me, adolescence is where it's at. Maybe I'm still trying to figure out, like, what was that? What was that time in my life? But it was very formative. And I just feel called to those stories. Now, that said, I have young kids now, and I had always wanted to write a picture book or two. And only recently do I feel like I kind of cracked the code to picture book writing. I do have two picture books under contract that
are
hopefully coming out in 2017.
I was gonna say, only after you read hundreds of them to your children. Exactly. And then you were like, exactly. Oh yeah. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. So when you take the time and you sit down and you see how kids read them and react to them and what works and what doesn't. And like, just how their little brains work, like the questions they ask and how they process stuff.
That's right. It's that same quality of why so many like librarians write for children too, because you read to them all the time and you're able to see reaction immediately. Kids show reactions. I mean, even with your YA students, they show it immediately to you. They don't hide anything back, or maybe older kids hide a little bit, but no, you're a visiting author. They don't hide anything from you. You're a guest. You're the rock star.
No, like they're that. Always like the first 5 minutes are always very formal and like polite and like kind of wary too, like looking at me like, can we really say what we think to you? And I always kind of, even in my introduction, I'm like, I value honesty. If you read a book and you don't like it, even if it's my book, especially if it's my book, I want to know. I want you to tell me why. I want you to think about what you're reading.
Right.
And they do.
And that acknowledgement at that age, especially, that we don't write books for everybody. We write books for, certain readers will find certain books, and that's who they're meant for. It's not meant, you can't possibly write a story to appeal to every single person, which is what makes it even more special when it's that feeling of like, oh, wow, Hannah wrote this for me. Or, this is the time in my life that I need to be reading this book.
Yeah.
That's special.
Yeah. And that's what I loved about being a bookseller, too. I worked at a couple different independent bookstores in Boston. And that moment where you're like, a kid comes in and they're like, I liked this and I liked this. And you're like, oh, dude, I know exactly what to give you.
Oh, heck yeah.
And then they come back and they tell you how perfect it was.
See, Hannah, I knew you were good people. We have this connection. I love this.
Yes.
You're right. That's the greatest thing ever. That's sort of what propels me constantly as a teacher or a school librarian, is that it's sort of the testament of how well we know each other. And the kids know me. I'm saying that too. They know me. They know what books, all they have to do is mention certain titles to me, and they know I will be the one in that school or maybe in their life that'll be excited about the news about whatever book they've been reading. I'm going to be that person. It's reliable. And same with when you're working at a bookstore or you're recommending whatever. That is so special, I think, on both sides, on the kid hearing the recommendation and also on you being able to give that recommendation or hear back from them to have the satisfaction of making that connection. I love that feeling.
Yeah. Yeah, there's really nothing like it.
When you get the feeling of like, kids going, I know this story, I've walked this life, that's amazing. I mean, to be able to write, to be able to breathe words into a story that some kid can say, reading this made me understand my own my own grief better, my own life better, my own whatever I'm confused about better. That's awesome.
Yeah, I really hope that it can do that.
Are you kidding me? It totally can. And then when your picture books come out, you get kids drawing fan art, which is even better.
Oh my gosh, I can't wait. I'm really so excited for this.
Hannah, you're really playing the market here. I'm really quite jealous of you, playing both the young and the old and getting both sides
now
of it.
Now I need the in-between. I need a middle grade. I need a chapter book. I got to hit like all the bases.
Oh, that's fun. I think that takes a special... I have a theory, my own theories about this. But I feel like not all authors can do that. Because I think it takes something to tap in and to do that well. And I don't think there's many that do it. I mean, I think... every one of us might agree that like Kate DiCamillo is able to do it very well.
Yes.
All of the different age ranges,
yeah,
audiences.
She's okay.
She's all right. Yeah. Have you read Raimi yet? Have you got an arc of Raimi yet? Oh my gosh. Hold on.
I saw your picture when you opened the box and I was so jealous.
It might be her best. And that's saying something, but this is all just to say, to be able to write for multiple audiences, I think is, like the same quality of being able to teach for multiple grade levels. It's not a skill that everyone has.
No, but you know what I think the key is in either case is being open to meeting kids where they're at. Like
thank
where
you.
They're,
yes.
Where they're really at and not coming to teaching or writing or parenting even. I mean, I've said to friends of mine, like for me, the biggest challenge of being a parent is letting go of who I thought my kids would be and meeting them, like meeting who they really are.
Yeah, discovering who they are.
Yeah.
And finding joy that there's you in them.
Right.
But yet you get to enjoy life with this totally new person. Yeah, thank God they're not you. You don't want them to be you. I think that all the time about my kid. My wife is a music teacher and I'm a librarian. And, you know, for years we thought, like, I wonder if he's going to be into books or into music. And there's some signs that just shows he's not the same kid as both of us. But then you step back and go, thank God he's not the same kid as both of us. Like who wants that?
Right. No. And he's going to have his own stuff and he's going to teach you about that stuff. And it's going to be awesome.
No doubt. It is awesome. Oh, before I let you go, cause our time is like running out, but I have to say, this is always something that I'm drawn to. And my friend Carter Higgins and I talk about it a lot. I love the design of your book cover a lot.
Isn't it pretty?
It's really, really pretty. I'll put an image in the show notes for people to see it. But to get the cover of it and then to start reading and then to start getting it and going like, oh, this is really a smart cover.
Yeah.
Broken up this way and just it's really a nice design. And I don't know how designing works. I mean, that's something that's another part of the publishing process and part of also being an artist that is just – I guess you sort of know when it works and you go on a hunch and sometimes I guess it doesn't work, but
yeah, I mean, hopefully, you know, it's tough. Like for Wonder Show, my editor, it was published by the company that I had worked for and my editor was a good friend and a former colleague. And so I definitely, I think, got more input into the whole thing than most debut authors get. And then with some of the parts, it was maybe a little more traditional in that my editor and I didn't know each other personally as well. And the cover design, you know, was much more conceived in-house and like, and then, and they send you pictures. And sometimes there's some buildup, like, I'm going to have a cover design for you,
oh.
you know, in a few days or like next week. So then of course you start the picturing, like trying to picture, like, what's it going to look like?
And when they say that's all they say too, right? It's not, you don't get much input in it, right?
No,
it's
not usually.
Ish, yeah.
Right. And then, you know, so then you might get an email that's like, here it is. I hope you love it as much as we do. And that basically means, like, unless there's something seriously horribly wrong with it,
this is it.
Like, let's just go with it. And there were some adjustments. And I don't want to make it sound like publishers aren't open to hearing from their authors, because they certainly are. But the cover is such a specific thing because it is, you know, it is the face of the book and it is a sales tool.
Yes.
And a marketing tool. And authors are, you know, for right or wrong, are not always the best ones to decide how to sell their own books. And nor should we. that is not our job. You know, we should be, we need to be writing the next book. We need to be thinking about other things.
Do you know, so, do you know the artist behind it? Do you know the, I wonder if it's in the, I want to look it up.
Yeah. So it's a photograph. And then the designer, I think an in-house designer did the text, the type treatment. And, and what I really love, and I didn't realize until I got the finished bound books, is, the spot, the way that they did the spot gloss so that the picture is all sort of shiny and glimmery. And then the letters are like matte and they're really like almost cutting into the picture.
Right.
I just, it's so genius. I love it.
I love,
and I could never have thought of that. I mean, I would never have come up with that, which is why
from a
don't design.
That's why, you don't design. I like from a design perspective that because of the color of the photo, and it's a, I should say it's a boy. It's obviously supposed to be Nate, and the letters are sort of, it looks like it's a, well, it just looks like the letters are sort of suspended in the way that they're cut out from this paper. So it's made to look like different pieces. I'm sure the listeners are hearing this connection between the pieces of Nate and organ donation and all that. But what I really liked, anyway, stepping back to the thing I like, is that it looks like the letter I.
Yeah.
Whenever I looked at it, I keep thinking that. And I'm like, this is such a story of like seeing yourself in Nate and this brother. And it just, there was just something about the design that I felt like this was all intentional and it looks really good. And it was, there was decisions made about this that work.
Yeah, definitely.
Anyway, it's a pretty cover, Hannah. You get to stare at a really pretty cover. And I think to have that cover being handed to you over and over at signing events and all that, it's pretty awesome. It's really nice.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. Our time has to end. Hannah, our time has to end. We have to wrap this up because clearly we could be recording a 5-hour conversation here. And I like that quality about you, Hannah Barnaby. Okay. I'm assembling an all-star Kidlit Dream Team kickball tournament. And I have been waiting to find out what one person you would want on your team, alive or past, from this children's publishing world and why.
I've also sort of been waiting to see what I was going to say because I've had so many thoughts about, I have thoughts about this.
I'm flattered. Wow.
So I am not by any stretch an accomplished kickball player. But I'm a pretty competitive person. So I definitely would want someone who's going to further my team in the tournament. And I don't know what kind of kickball player James Marshall would have been, but I have to think he would have been a whole lot of fun to play with. And like probably a good, like aggressive, but in his own very entertaining, sweet way. So I'm going to go with James Marshall.
I think that's a good choice. It's one that I've heard before because of those same qualities. That's a nice one.
Yeah. Can I tell you who my runner-up was?
Who, you have a runner-up? Wow. I love this thought. Well, my word.
Because, you know, James Marshall may not be available for various reasons.
Fair.
He might be out partying too much to show up to the tournament. And so my stringer is Jack Gantos.
Oh, geez.
Because Jack, I feel like, would just break all kinds of rules to get the job done. And I like that about him. And he was my first writing teacher at Simmons.
What?
Yeah, I did an independent study with Jack on creative nonfiction.
Oh, that's awesome. I remember hearing Drew Daywalt also talk about having Jack as an instructor. That he seems like an amazing human being.
Yes.
He certainly got a storied life, which is fantastic.
That's good to have when you're a writer.
no doubt. Well, Hannah, thank you so much for coming on the podcast, for sharing some of the parts. Good luck with everything happening this year for you with this book. And thanks again for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
Let's Get Busy is recorded and produced by me, Matthew Winner, in my library studio in Ellicott City, Maryland, and by All the Wonders, a home for readers to discover new books and to experience the stories they love in wondrous ways. Go beyond the book at allthewonders.com. And check out other podcasts from All the Wonders, including the Picture Booking Podcast with Nick Patton and The Best Book Ever This Week. Our theme music is by Blue Ducks. All views and opinions expressed on the show are those of the individuals, myself included, and do not reflect ideas or viewpoints of the publishers of the books referenced. Listeners, if this episode connected with you, I'd love to hear it. Leave a comment on allthewonders.com or rate Let's Get Busy on iTunes or Stitcher through stars or reviews. Sharing the podcast with friends through Facebook, Twitter, word of mouth, or any other means helps reach more listeners, which leads to more content and more amazing guests. And that is a very good thing indeed.
Next up on Let's Get Busy, Hannah Barnaby shares the story behind Some of the Parts, her YA novel. And later in the week, Keith Negley talks about Tough Guys Have Feelings Too, a wonderful picture book from Flying Eye. See you then, and thanks for listening.
We know you value what you put in front of your kids, especially when it comes to screens and podcasts. That's why we're excited to share a new podcast from our friends at Sleepiest, creating bedtime stories to help your kids fall asleep fast.
Hello, Abby here. If you've got children and find bedtime's a struggle, I'd like to tell you about Coco Sleep, a children's story podcast designed to make bedtime a dream. Coco Sleep turns a chaotic bedtime into cozy bonding time. The stories are delivered in a pace that gently slows. Rumour has it that no one's ever heard an ending. So search Coco Sleep on your favourite podcast app and let's make bedtime a dream. That's K-O-K-O Sleep, and I'll see you there.